Buck Desateremus for those who are accustomed to us doing sports in the news in the second hour on Mondays. So we can continue our conversation with Nick and Glenn. We're going to postpone that to the second hour tomorrow. I do have a question for you, though, Nick, as we rejoin. There was this last spot in the news where they were talking about those who are no longer looking for jobs, no longer being counted as unemployed. Do you know what the actual number of unemployed Americans is? And this would be Americans between the ages of 20 and 55. What percentage of Americans between 20 and 55 are actually unemployed?
Well, I don't know exact numbers, but I know where you're going with it because I listened to someone else somewhere else, and they say that pretty much the same thing you do. They don't count those who do not look for jobs. So
correct.
I mean,
they don't count anyone who doesn't look for a job. They don't count anyone who has never had a job. They don't count anyone who is grossly underemployed. The actual number is 55%. If you count just totally unemployed, it's 50%. If you count grossly unemployed, it's 55.
Numbers, as though they say, do not lie, but you can use those numbers in your own benefit in any way you want.
Yeah, particularly this idea that we have, you know, 8% unemployment in America. The number's not even remotely close to
the
actual number.
Well, it's the same as you know, suicide rate, at which, I mean, they're
yes.
Huge numbers, too. So, I mean,
yeah. All right. I understand you had other questions or comments or points that you wanted to make.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, listening to the podcast, and there was one day when two of the other owners of the websites about Yawa and all three of you were having a wonderful conversation. It was just like listening birds singing.
Oh, well, thank you.
As soon as you stop complimenting yourselves on wonderful websites and everything else, it got interesting.
Well, thank you. Yeah, there was a conversation between Don and Frank and I, and Don and Frank do have independent websites, which
if,
I'm very fond of.
If you could replace your sport talk with you, all three of you, you know, joining somehow at least once a week, I mean, that would be just beautiful.
Yeah, it was really, it was marvelous. The idea initially was for Don, who had been a deacon in the Seventh-day Adventist Church and was responsible for promoting their agenda, particularly through their publication of books. As an insider, wanted to add some comments to what I had said about their 28 pillars all being erroneous. And we started there, and it was interesting that, you know, he said that he was told to leave the church because he was interested in what the oldest copies of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms from the Dead Sea Scrolls, what they actually said. And
so then the
Dead
Sea Scrolls are actually not a good thing to be translating because they're all in the Masoretic text and stuff. So these were.
The reason that the Seventh-day Adventist leadership didn't want him studying the Dead Sea Scrolls is that the Seventh-day Adventist religion is based upon
the
writings,
based on law.
Right? The inspiration of Helen G. White, and Helen G. White couldn't read Hebrew, she couldn't read Greek. All of her inspiration came from her interpretation of the King James Bible in English. And if somebody were then to go to the original language and older manuscripts and could show that what she was commenting on was untrue, it would, of course, destroy the entire illusion and the edifice of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and they'd lose, when that's exposed, you know, they could lose all 20 million members.
Yeah, no, that happens. So, yeah, and it's not like I don't like the sports. I mean, I just, I never got to. It's maybe it's because I'm not American, and most of Americans probably do like your sport talk because, I mean, they all have like either football or baseball or where I don't understand either one of those things. So I guess I'm probably alone in
you know, what's interesting is that today we were going to talk about international sanctioning bodies of sports. For example, the Formula One sanctioning body that's now under all sorts of criticism for bribery. The football, International Football Association, which puts on the World Cup, and the bribes that they allegedly received in millions of dollars for giving the World Cup upcoming, not the one that's starting here in a week or so, but to Qatar. The International Olympic Committee that was bribed into giving Rio de Janeiro the Olympics, even though the city isn't even remotely, I mean, not even remotely prepared to host the Olympics. And we were going to then also include the NCAA, which is an American body, and their corruption as well. But you know, I understand that that sports is not
I know enough that here in Minnesota, because they agreed to rob taxpayers to build a new stadium, they gave them a Super Bowl. You know,
that is correct.
Hosting the Super Bowl, so that is
correct.
All happy and hoping that they will pay off the you know, the stadium by hosting the Super Bowl and somehow save the Democrats who robbed.
Yeah. Yeah, my interest in sports in the news, Nick, is because having studied Rome and Greece, and recognizing that Rome and Greece are really the model for what we're going to witness in the future and how those empires evolved, both of those empires used sports spectacle to cause their citizens, A, to be patriotic, just as America does with sporting events and much of the world does, and B, to be distracted so that they really wouldn't know what was being done to them. And so I find the kind of the expression of sports and the corruption of it and the politics of it and the religion that is attached to it really indicative of exactly what went wrong in Rome and Greece and what's going to continue to go wrong in this country. So there is actually a tie-in.
So something funny I want to tell you.
Yes.
About my wife, actually.
Okay.
You know, she doesn't believe any religion, or, I mean, she just as far away from any religion as far as she can, because, you know, none of it makes sense to her. So when I do start talking about Torah, it's just, it scares you out, just like she thinks that it's like, you know, it's one of those other religions.
Right,
And it's hard to even put anything.
That's very common, Nick, amongst, I would say, most agnostics and atheists think that the moment you mention the Torah, that you're speaking of a religious text because that's what they've been told, when in fact it's an anti-religious text.
And the funny thing is that she quoted something from Torah without even knowing that she did it.
What did she say?
There was one time she says, stop searching, because if you keep searching, you will find it. And that's what what I heard from the Torah, is that you keep seeking the knowledge and you will find it.
Yeah, it's actually the living manifestation of the Torah. Yosha made that statement in his ode to the Torah during his Sermon on the Mount. But you know, the Torah is the most quoted book in the world, and it's quoted in every kind of environment because it is so eminently quotable. Its statements are so profound.
The thing is, she quoted it without even knowing what she was quoting. It was her own thing is what she said. And I said, your own thing was written more than 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the reasons why I try so hard to expose corruption in in politics and religion during the first hour is, as I would love more people to come to realize that that God is as anti-religious as your wife is. God has no tolerance whatsoever for religion, and that his book of guidance, his teaching, is designed to be known and understood, and it's written in the same way that we would do a scientific inquiry. Examine the evidence, evaluate it, test it, and come up with what you think are the most reasonable conclusions based upon the evidence. And if you could just,
I'm thinking it would be so much nicer if he would make it just a little bit easier, or at least not as accessible.
Yeah.
Because the other day when you, all three of you were talking about the Yahweh and how that Seventh-day Adventist, the guy came to know Yahweh. He have brought up some tools that he used to translate the stuff, and he said that the tools he used is cheaper than other ones by thousands of dollars. I don't even know if I have hundreds to spend on any kind of tools. I mean, I don't, but my wife won't let me. I mean, there's like, so yeah, that's one thing that I'm kind of upset about. But he made it. Not that he made it. I suppose we just lost it, so I can't blame him for making it hard. We did it to ourselves, but yeah, it's kind of suck.
Yeah, no, I understand that there is a it is challenging. Now, if you don't want to, in this particular case, the tool that he came up with is was only about $100 as opposed to thousands of dollars. I would tell you that there are two things that you may want to think of. One is that all of the books that I have written that not only provide these translations but explain the translations, they're all available free. So you don't have to pay a penny for them, and you know those books.
Torah, that's where I'm kind of confused, because all of your books cannot be called Torah. It's all translations and or what's not. But what Torah says that you're supposed to read Torah and not what the other people write about it.
Yeah.
What you did is you wrote about it. You didn't write the Torah.
Both. First of all, Torah means teaching, and so Yahweh's teaching permeates his Torah and his prophets, so it's the entire Hebrew text. And all of those books are based upon what that text says. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Nick. We still have Glenn on the line talking about what is the most efficient way in terms of cost and time, mostly in cost, to study Yahweh's Torah? Nick, the first series of books that I wrote called Diyariya, the first chapter of a volume of that book, about 700-800 pages, is based entirely on the first book of the Torah. It's based entirely on Bereshith Genesis. And so all it does is say, this is what God said, translated from Hebrew into English, showing all of the Hebrew words and describing them. And this is what it is revealing to us. And then in the book called Introduction to God, almost all of it is focused on the Torah. Now, the Torah being strictly the first five books of called Bereshith Genesis, going through Devarim, Deuteronomy words. But the way that it is written is, I'll review it. This is what God says. We'll take the passage that he wrote, and I'll provide an amplified translation of it. Then I'll explain in further depth what the legacy of those words mean and where those words were used elsewhere, and related passages to it, so that so you go from knowing to understanding the text. And all of that's free. If you want to translate the Hebrew testimony that Yahweh revealed on your own. There are many websites that provide free access to interlinears and to Hebrew lexicons. So you can do it for free. The program that Don is using is called Quick Verse. You can Google Quick Verse. And it's the program that I started with way back when I just began this whole curiosity as to what the Hebrew text actually said. I began with Quick Verse. I don't use it anymore. But it is, in fact, vastly cheaper. A Quick Verse, the package looks like it's available for, $150, for example. So, again, I can't speak of it because I haven't used Quick Verse in 12 years, but it's very, very inexpensive.
Oh, well, I keep coming back to this, and I'm sorry for, keep, mm-hmm. I guess I'm like the broken record. I'm keep saying it, so, because it's like,
okay.
It's that Bible is based on Torah too, and so
right.
for us not to read Bible, but to read what you're saying means we have to trust you and not to Bible. And therefore, at some point back in time, people had the same choice with the Bible, where they had the choice either go and try to translate the versions of Torah themselves, or just to believe to what other guys says about the Bible, or come up with.
There's a slight difference here, and the difference is actually enormous. In that, all I'm saying about the term Bible is that it's a bogus name. That God never called his testimony Bible. It's the name of a pagan sun goddess. So the name that religious institutions are applying to the text is inappropriate. The three quarters of what you would find, maybe even 80% of what you'll find in a Bible, happens to be a translation of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So 75% to 80% of what's there is exactly what I am focused on in translating. There is no difference in the text that we are both attempting to translate and understand. The difference is only in the accuracy of our translations. And what I don't actually say, trust me. In fact, if you read any one of the books, I begin them by saying, don't trust me. Trust Yahweh. Don't trust me. Don't trust anybody. And the reason that my translations aren't simply translations, the reason I don't say, this is my translation of the Hebrew text and leave it at that, is because I don't want you to have to trust me. I want you to be able to look up the Hebrew words, because I present the Hebrew words right in the midst of the translation, putting them in italics, so that you can use any one of the free online dictionaries, Hebrew dictionaries, to look up the words and to verify for yourself if those translations are accurate and complete. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. We're having a conversation with Nick as to how you go about studying Yahweh's teaching. And that's been the purpose of yadaya.com. If you just type in yadaya.com, it'll take you to the Yada Yah site. Also, there's introtogod.org, even questioningpaul.com. Nick, over the past 12 or so years that I've had these books up, and the first was the opening chapters of Yada Yah, which has been up now about 12 years, I've received thousands of emails from people who have read them. And almost all of them, these emails say the same thing. One is that as people began to read what God actually said, the first reaction is, that's what they suspected all along. Now, most of the people who have done it are like your wife. They're anti-religious. They're agnostics, mostly. And almost all of them, their first comment is that this makes sense. It's exactly as I would have expected God to be. And the second is that every single one, I mean, thousands of emails now over these past 12 years, every single one said that the translations were so different than what they had been accustomed to hearing and seeing, that they, even though they resonated with them, even though they made sense, they went and initially, every time there was a word that was really different than what would be found in an English Bible, they looked it up online. And there, as I say, there's lots of free sites. There's scores of them that you can look up Hebrew words online. And they came to find out that these translations were consistent with the definitions of these words. And after they had done it hundreds of times where they verified them, that they said, well, you know, this is an accurate rendering of Yahweh's testimony. And then began to read. Now, the third thing that is ubiquitous in every one of these thousands of letters is that after the person invested the time to come to know Yahweh, after they did their verification, every one of them now shares insights that I missed along the way. In other words, they have grown in many ways beyond what I've shared. So they've now engaged in the voyage of discovery, and I enjoy it immensely. Is that helpful?
Yep. Well, I'll hang up and I'm gonna listen to you online.
Okay. All right. My suggestion would be, you know, to go to yadayah.com. Begin there and read the first volume. 100% of the first volume is based on the Torah, and the commentary that I have is strictly designed to encourage thoughtful contemplation of what God has said. You know, you don't have to agree with my commentary, but if nothing else, the commentary will cause you to think about what you've heard, and you may come to other conclusions about the what God said. And I'm going to tell you, Nick, when others share with me the conclusions that they have ascertained from the text, I almost always find them consistent with what I know about God, but beyond what I might have seen in the text. And I receive those kind of emails now every day. So I would encourage you, you're very smart, that if you go on this voyage of discovery and begin to read these books, and in particular, Introduction to God. Introduction to God exists to provide those who are serious about knowing Yahweh with a toolbox, so that you're prepared to analyze the text yourself. And then, rather than just saying, all right, here's the toolbox, have at it, it provides 1,200 pages of examples of how these tools are used on many of the most interesting things to Yahweh, so that you actually get to see the tools being used in a discussion of Yahweh's testimony. So that's what I would encourage. Nick, what do you think? Or Glenn, what do you think about all of that?
Did I pass?
But what do you mean? Did you pass?
What? The hour-long patience test.
Oh, yeah, I was thinking that's what you probably were probably suggesting. Yes, you get a gold star for yes, you get a gold star. You know, you're in a little that's why I asked you at the end of this. You're in a different place than Nick. I can appreciate Nick's place. I enjoy the place that you're at as well. But it's probably a challenge for you because you're just in such a different place than where Nick is.
I got that. Yeah, no, I understand. But I have yet to do, you know, more due diligence on reading this. That's why I don't chime in too much on that, because I like right now I just got done working night shift. Into an animal care all morning. I was like, all my free time. Mm-hmm. And when I read, I tend to fall asleep sometimes.
Yeah.
So actually,
yeah.
So yeah,
yeah, I think
I actually need to do some of the same reading he needs to do.
You're right. Yeah, that's why I think he enjoyed so much the conversation we had last week between Frank and Don, is here's just two ordinary guys. One happened to be, in fact, both of them happened to be quite religious. One had just been spurned by his religion, and the other was really open-minded and wanted to go where the words lead or led. And so this discussion with those two guys that came from very different places yesterday, or Friday of last week, and how they ultimately led both of us into the covenant and the fascination that we now have with what we learn. And the deeper we look, the deeper we dig, the more we're focused, the more enlightening the text becomes. So that's why I think that conversation resonated with him.
Yeah, exactly. And Don's experience would have been like far different from mine, within an affiliation with a different denomination, which, you know, they had a liberal arts college for which they were seeking ever greater credibility in the academy, so they were, like, welcoming of, like, Harvard scholars on the staff and stuff like that. And so they would have, like, you know, encouraged, they wouldn't have tried to block somebody from seeking, you know.
Right.
You know, even in my curriculum, they, you know, encourage us, you know, to seek out stuff like that. So wouldn't necessarily lead where, you know, you think it should, but, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Try to spook you. But anyway, I had originally called to talk about the Bo Bergdahl thing.
Yes, go ahead.
The Taliban leaders, you know, they were treated to three hots and a cot. Like sports, like waterboarding and hygiene treatments, like razors to the genitals and stuff like that.
We're so loving and caring, aren't we? We're so concerned about our inmates, yes.
So, you know, and Bergdahl, meanwhile, Bergdahl's drinking kawa tea and helping serve dinner, and now we're supposed to believe that he's slept in a cage, you know?
Yeah.
They let the guy handle their food, but lock him up in a cage at night.
I'm convinced personally that the purpose of this 2 weeks period is to create a plausible scenario that causes Bergdahl's testimony not to be wholly embarrassing to the administration.
Plus, he's in such a heightened state of suggestibility going back to the, you know, the culture tunnel again, the other side.
Right. Back yes.
So he's like a totally like brainwashable, hyper suggestible.
Sure.
It's like he can be like, he can just be roped into Stockholm syndrome for his new captors. You know.
Of course. Absolutely. So, and I think what they're going to be determining is whether or not over these 2 weeks that they can send him out and that he can engage with the media in such a way that he's not going to completely embarrass the administration. Therefore, that he's going to articulate the new story that they're crafting on his behalf, that he really was a poor POW and he was caged like an animal and therefore we were right to go get him. Or whether or not, you know, he'll go back to the original story of, God, I hate my country and I hate what we were doing in Afghanistan. And, I left my post on purpose. I didn't want to be part of the American military anymore. So you didn't leave me behind. I left you behind. And if that's the case, then they're going to have to incarcerate him.
Right, right. Well, speaking of incarceration, I'd like to know, while we're swapping people, I'd like to know what about the 30%, more than 30% of the Camp X-Ray prisoners who have been cleared by the military tribunals as mere patsies? You know,
yes, really.
Because then they'll tell what actually happened to them, and that's going to be a black eye. So they keep them there.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that within 2 years, Gitmo is going to be shut down. So
yeah, but
we will
just transfer them to another, you know, to Leavenworth or something.
You know, the problem is they can't bring them to the United States because the only reason they're in Gitmo is because they're being kept both apart from the Geneva Convention as a prisoner of war, because we're not at war with the with Islam, and second of all, they can't be brought here, because if we were to apply normal American jurisprudence to them and the admission of evidence, those trials are going to be hugely embarrassing for the United States, because it's going to be brought out that the only thing that these prisoners had in common is that they were all devout Muslims.
Right.
And so,
and a lot of them were just sold out for the reward money. Oh, money? Oh, yeah, that guy, I never liked him.
Yeah, right. So, and for us to have spent all this money keeping them in prison for all this period of time has been counterproductive. Now, there is a one thought that would cause one to say that Gitmo might stay open. The Muslims are going to be returned. I mean, they can't be brought in the United States for trial. And they, we don't want to treat them as if they were prisoners of war. The one reason why it has some advantage is in terms of the Patriot Act now, somebody who is suspected of terrorism, which is broad, very loosely defined, can be deprived of their rights. They can be brought to a place. Yeah, they can be brought to a place like Gitmo, where you have absolutely no legal recourse.
Or rendition to other countries where they're not quite as gentle.
Right. Well, in fact, that's really how the CIA perpetrated most of its interrogations, was that we did it in other countries where we thought we could get by with being sadistic. So all of that is true. Well, Glenn, if you want to hang on for another few minutes through the break, you might get your star elevated from gold to platinum, and we can continue to talk about Bo Bergdahl and other issues of embarrassment to the United States. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Shannon Mist. We still have Glenn on the line. Hey, Glenn, what is your impression of Slender Man and the girls that thought that they ought to go off and stab a classmate? I think they stabbed a classmate like 30 times.
It sounds to me like internet-induced schizophrenia. These people are schizophrenia means split from reality. It's a schism. The schism is a split. And the people, it's not split personality. That's that multiple personality disorder. People
right.
mix that up. But this seems like literally internet-induced schizophrenia. That means
yes,
they
it does.
Were split off from reality.
Yeah. It is, in fact, I think it's impossible not to come to that conclusion. Your analysis of what the schiz is and schizophrenia is beyond most people's conclusions, but it is impossible to disassociate the artificial world of Slender Man and his horror stories and his call to become part of his cult by killing someone from what those girls did. They were, they somehow were unable to differentiate between the imaginary online world and the real world.
Right. It's right. That lack of differentiation, along with a complete lack of empathy,
right.
you know, complete lack of grasp of the suffering, the real world suffering that's caused, or any empathy for it. I mean, that it's just unbelievable.
Hey, or just our moral judgment. You know, why would you want to be part of something, even if it were real, which, of course, Slender Man is not. But why would you want to be part of something that would have you kill an innocent person?
Well, it's the same as the delusional revolution people who shot the policeman. You know,
yes.
these people are, you know, delusional in
right.
the truest sense of the word, you know.
Unable to exercise good judgment, and therefore
well,
delusional.
Yeah, I mean, well, you don't have to have you don't have to be delusional to have to be you know
correct.
Poor judgment, you know. But yeah, they're certainly that, you know. But in the extreme, you know.
Yeah, but if you indoctrinate a generation of people so as to discourage them from exercising good judgment. And then you have these other influences, whether it be white supremacy, whether it be the conspiracies associated with white supremacy, or the make-believe world of the internet, in terms of this false realm of this Slender Man. It takes a lot less now for someone to go off the deep end and express their delusion violently.
The whole thing is so addictive. I mean, I just saw a situation over the weekend where a parent had to, like, you know, threaten the child with, you know, having the phone taken away because she wasn't engaging in you know, helping with a real-world material task that had to be performed. It's like, you're supposed to be helping here. You put the phone down and then take it away.
You know? Right.
And they're so addicted.
And, they are so addicted.
And I can sort of see how this happened. I remember thinking about this back in the 80s with all the video games. It's like, are they using these video games as, like, training, you know, to conditioning?
Right.
And I remember I played, it was in the late 1990s, even as an adult. I got playing a first-person shooter game called Quake, one of the first generation of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I spent about a week of part-time, you know, in my discretionary time in the evenings playing this thing until I finally went through to the end and killed the big bad monster at the end. And I thought, and then it was over, and I thought, oh, my God, what have I just done? Yeah, what
right.
I was like, I will never invest this much. This is that. That's it. I will never invest that much time in it.
But you know, there are some online shooter games and some online fantasy games where people devote all of their free time and they live in that false world and they never seem to emerge from it. They only work for the ability to go back, you know, to have the electricity and the internet connection and the computer to go back and play the game. They're living,
right.
They're really living in the false world. It was my biggest concern about the, my biggest problem with the first-person shooter games, Glenn, was that what you're doing is encouraging someone to behave in counterproductive, vicious, deadly behavior with the mindset that all I have to do is reboot and everybody is fine, that I can be killed in the pursuit of the bad guy and I just start the game over and I get a new life. But
right, you don't, nobody gets a new life.
Yeah, but no one really gets a new life, and when you kill somebody, they're really dead, and if they kill you, you're really dead, and it's such a tragic way of desensitizing people to the great consequence of their actions. Well, we'll return with Shattering Myths after the news and commercial break. Thank you so much for contributing, Glenn.